Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Winemaking-wise, you're the winemaker of record?
I am, on all of these projects. So, again, an opportunity to wipe the slate clean. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you were getting at when you first asked me, you know, what were you looking at? What were you looking to do with the Patson Hall at the very beginning? It really comes full circle here. I started with the idea that this isn't going to be Patson Hall 2.0. You know, Maritana is its own project. It's going to have its own life. It's going to go its own direction. And what is it that I want to drink right now? What is it that I think is interesting? And also, you know, what's the current climate? If I went back to I don't want to wear the clothes that we all wore in 1988, let alone drink the wines that we all thought were great. And it's a mistake to think that there isn't some kind of fashion element to the wine business. I mean, it really is obvious if you've been around for a while that fashion has an impact on it. And by that I mean a particular style of winemaking or a particular winemaker or a particular kind of way of packaging it all are timely and change over time. So I took what we did at Patson Hall and I said, some of this stuff I want to keep, but I want to rethink the whole thing. And so I wanted to create something different with Chardonnay and something different with Pinot Noir. And where I started was obviously with the sources. So I'm buying grapes from different places than Patson Hall did. Different parts of the Dutton Ranch, but different parts than Patson Hall purchased. And I'm asking for the grapes to be picked a little bit less ripe, I think, than we would have had them picked at Patson Hall. Again, to get good acidity, really bright, fresh characters in the wine. And to frame that, and particularly with the La Riviere Chardonnay, I want to use only small amounts of new barrels, not large amounts. So I found a source of one-year-old barrels that I can buy every year. They are used once, and then I get them. And so I'm 90% of the 2017 La Riviere Chardonnay is in one-year-old barrels, 10% in brand-new barrels. The single vineyard wines will get a little bit more, but still not anything like what we used to do at Patson Hall, which frequently would be 50 to 75% brand new barrels for Chardonnay. The maximum I'd like to see is something like 30% new barrels. And I just think that today, in this style of winemaking that I want to pursue, a little less new barrels will allow that floral mineral character that I'm trying to extract out of these grapes to show through better, as opposed to, you know, really flashy winemaking with lots of expensive new barrels to try to create the wine. Now, this isn't the choices I'm making here really don't have anything to do with the costs. It's easy to sort of be cynical and say, oh, he's really saying he wants to use these used barrels so that he can make extra money on the wine. That's not the case. What I'm saying is that I think that the wine is a better wine by using one-year-old barrels. And that's what I'm interested in, not just, you know, throwing as much money against this as possible because I want it to be expensive. I think the driver here is the cost of the grapes and the, you know, the processing fees and things like that really have made these wines expensive as well. And I've got extraordinary sights. So very excited about the Chardonnay. Pinot 2017 is a blend of three vineyards, each one of which was okay by itself, but amazingly, when I blended, and this is no sarcasm, I was really shocked how good the wine turned out when I put the blend together. And so immediately tried to get it blended before I had to try them separately anymore. Because the wines were okay, but not great. 2018, I've got a whole new program, so we'll get to that maybe another day. But 2017 Larousse Chardonnay, I think, is delicious, and I'm really excited about it. It's a little under 14% alcohol, and really bright and focused, and it's the style that I want to try to continue to do. Although alcohol levels really aren't the critical thing. I just mention it because I was kind of surprised to see it was under 14 myself. So we have those two, and then what did I do with single vineyard? So I knew I wanted to do a single vineyard Chardonnay. I had this site called Hanson Hill from Dutton Ranch that is an extraordinary. It's kind of the core, the most expensive Chardonnay they grow. It is a key piece for both Kistler and Dumal Vineyard and Dumal Wines for their, I'm not sure even Dumal does a Dutton Ranch designation, but it's for a big chunk of their best stuff is coming right from this vineyard. It's a hillside site, very close to their offices. Their mother lives right next door to it. She walks it all the time, so she demands that they make it pretty. But it's a per acre deal, so you know that you're going to be able to ask for a little bit of extra stuff from the Duttons at Hanson Hill. That was an automatic. The other Dutton Ranch site that I purchased, I really was thinking was going to be entirely used in La Riviere. And it's called Shop Block. And the more I looked at this vineyard during the year, and the more that I got a chance to try the wines in barrel, I realized I really had to produce at least some of this as a single vineyard designate. Shop Block is interesting because it's the only piece of the original plantings of Dutton Ranch that still exist. So they've ripped out parts around it and replanted, in some cases, a couple of different times. And so much of Dutton Ranch really is this extended series of vineyards that sort of scatter all over Sonoma County. And if you're curious about this, you can look at their website, and they have a map that includes all of their vineyards and all their apple orchard sites. And it looks like they should change the name of Sonoma County to Dutton County if you look at this. It's incredible how much land they've got. But to be able to get grapes from the original planting, the place where Warren Dutton started all of his purchases of vineyards and the legend that came out of his work in the vineyards through Kistler as well as many other people is really extraordinary. So to be able to get those grapes is really amazing. And I went to see the Duttons fairly early after I left Patson Hall and got into the truck. They drove me like 100 yards from their office and stopped, and I could not believe it. I said, "Why are we stopping?" And they told me that the grapes were available. I said, "Why are these grapes available? 50 plus year old Chardonnay vines. Why would these be available? Why wouldn't somebody be eager to keep them?" They said, "The guy who's been buying them has been purchasing them for 15 plus years. It could be even longer. I'm sure it's at least 15 years, but it might have been 20 plus years. And had failed to pay his bills for a couple of years now, and they were taking the contract back and they were offering it to me." I was shocked and surprised and thrilled to be able to get that, as far as I know, the only 50-year-old Chardonnay vines in West County in Sonoma that are currently being grown.
Wow.
Kind of incredible, isn't it?
I'm sure that you're just so pleased about this development. I could see it in your eyes right now that this was a very special moment.
It is. It's really exciting. And I don't have any single vineyard Pinots from 2017, but I've got a whole cluster of them coming up from 2018. So that'll be a lot of fun too. But Chardonnay, that's where I started my own wine projects, and it's really fun to see the transition from Patson Hall to these. Are I don't think anybody would taste one of these and say, "Oh, that's exactly like a Patson Hall wine," and that's exactly what I want. I want them to be a different style. I want them to stand on their own, but at the same time, I want them to be delicious and compelling wines too.
So you said earlier that had you not started all those brands, you would just travel and...
I'd probably be dead. I mean, really. I mean, I think the most dangerous thing to do is to quit working. I don't know what... I just don't know what I would do if I didn't have some reason to get up and get going every morning with something important to do.
This is a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Everything
is more than I thought I was going to do.
Yeah, it's a monumental project. And, you know, you're doing this essentially outside of the Terminum. You're doing this alone.
Yes. Well, I have people that I can work with. And
yeah, people support.
That's right.
But at the end of the day, you're responsible for it.
Yeah. No, there's no one else but me.
And you decided to do all of that. because you're so driven to produce something that stimulates you.
It sounds sort of pretentious to say it that way, but yes. I mean, ultimately, you don't do this if you don't feel a burning desire to do something. And
this is not a money-making proposition by any stretch.
Not yet. Hopefully someday. I wouldn't mind.
But serious, you know, money. As much as you have invested, do you really expect to build yet another brand that's
No, this is not for sale. And, you know, we would have probably said the same thing about Patson Hall, but I really don't want to sell this. I would love to, you know, over time, look at, I'm not 25 anymore. I'm in my early 60s. So how long do I want to keep doing this at this level of intensity? And there is a limit to what anybody can do. Nobody lives forever. So where does it go from here? Well, I want to bring a couple of people on to work with me. And then hopefully over the next 5 or 6 years, they do more of it. I do a little less. But I want to be involved. I want to be able to come in and walk around vineyards and kick dirt and taste wine and talk about winemaking and, you know, do a little bit of traveling to talk about the wines. But I can't do the same level of intensity for the next 20 years. I won't be able to.
You mentioned your stepson, so is that going to be a family affair in that sense?
Doesn't look like it. Oh. I mean, he's got his own projects he's working on, so that's good. Yeah. Well, I have two children of my own as well. Neither one of them is interested in doing it. My daughter's a distiller.
She's a distiller. She's got a blossoming career.
She's absolutely fabulous at doing it. She's super intense.
Yeah.
You got to step back when she starts talking. But it's exciting to see her do that. My son's, Jordan, is he's in computer games and has done very well with that too. So, yeah, I'm proud of them. And I told them from the very beginning, what I'm doing is not something you have to feel an obligation to pursue after me. I'm doing it for me. So you should find the thing that you want to do and do it for you. So I guess they listened to me, kind of shockingly.
Well, apparently you're a good father, because that's very unselfish and very wise thing to teach your children, because otherwise they will feel that pressure.
It's a burden.
And a burden, conversely, so
it's a burden.
You can't force that.
And on top of that, then, you know, to whatever extent I've been successful, that feels like the bar that they have to jump over, that, you know, in their first year of work. I mean, that's not possible. So I said to them, look, if you're really interested in this and you can't think of anything else you'd rather do, then come along. We'll do it together. But if you're not, then no, you don't need to. Do what makes you get up every morning. And so I think they both have done that.
That is, I think, a very important moment for those that are listening. It's not just, you know, parents and children and business too, you know, passion. It really is a very important conversation we all have to have with ourselves. What makes you get up in the morning? What turns you on? What you cannot live without? Those are the things that we really need to consider, because, as you correctly pointed out, life's short.
Well, it feels shorter now.
Well, in that case, we need wine. So, because that seems to cure everything. On that note, I've been looking at some bottles. In fact, I've been quietly partaking in the Cépage d'Or. And that wine, again, you've already pointed out, has brilliant acidity and is a very successful blend.
There's no way that you would, well, if you are a real fan of Chardonnay in particular, there's no way that you would smell this and say, that's Chardonnay. And if you know Chardonnay, this smells really different. It's got, I don't know exactly how to, I mean, I've thought about this a lot. It's sort of elusive for me that it doesn't have that sort of classic Marsan white paste smell, but it's...
I'm not sure that I would have been able to call this wine. In fact, let me rephrase it. I'm quite sure that blind, I wouldn't have been able to call it. I certainly would not, I would have possibly gone to the white room. But it's not immediate. It has a very beautiful floral bouquet. And for those of you that have not had an opportunity to taste a lot or even any white Rhones, I would say this is a pretty extraordinary gateway because it's a very palate-pleasing wine.
I'll tell you a fun story. So Francois took back a case of this wine after it was bottled to France. Uh-huh. And he sent me a couple of different pictures of himself drinking it with his friends in France. Mm-hmm. And he said when he pours it for them, he doesn't tell them what it is. He doesn't show them the label. He just says, try this. And they're all trying to guess what it is. Of course, the first guess is it's got to be something French because you're a French guy and you're a French winemaker and you make wine. So it's probably somewhat loaded, but he said nobody's ever guessed it was California. And I'm kind of partly proud of that and kind of partly like not proud of that because I want these to be they're California wines. I'm not trying to mimic French wines, but I want that sort of nice interplay between the ideas of making French wine and the richness and liveliness of California fruit. So I think we're getting there.
It's very alive, but I think the reason they're going to the old world is because unfortunately they don't associate California wines with elegance enough. That will change with your participation and others like you that understand this kind of sophisticated, refined qualities that, you know, you can only coax if you're very mindful about what you do. And that those decisions is what you described earlier, which is what you do in the vineyard. And when those picking decisions and when you actually work with the fruit at very, well, you start with really good growers, but then you work with the fruit in early stages and you have a vision because you clearly do. And then you get rewarded by wines that are kind of chameleonic in the sense that you shouldn't be able to pin them down. Because to me, world-class wines, by definition, are world-class. You don't need to actually label them as, well, this is clearly California. I think it's a compliment.
Well, I think if it's clearly California, it's probably an exaggeration as well. You know, really ripe or really buttery or something like that. And then, you know, then it's easy to say, oh, that's got to be California because that's the style that they always do, right?
Yeah. But I think it's changing. I'm actually really wanting to hear your perspective because you've now observed wine industry and not just observed, actively participated. But I'm interested in the observational piece in both Sonoma and Napa. And, you know, even in my much more limited experience than yours, the changes have been pretty dramatic over the years. And the philosophy, the mentality has changed quite a bit.
I think it should. We're a new wine growing area. So we should feel free to experiment. I'm sort of taken aback by some winemakers, and they're relatively young guys, and I get that they're trying to make elbow room for themselves in the market and some of that stuff. So, I mean, you can tell I'm very sympathetic to people getting started in the wine business, but there's always been a sort of collegial feel about it in California that, you know, we're a beginning wine industry. We're all trying to make sure that this goes the right direction, and we work hard and are respectfully of each other. And I think that there's been less of that recently. More of a I'm right, everybody else is wrong. And so I really want to make sure that as we talk about it, your listeners understand that there isn't a right way or a wrong way to make wine. And ultimately, their taste is the arbiter for them. That it's great to read these wine writers and to, you know, to get new ideas about wines that you might want to try. Those are wonderful. But ultimately, if you don't like the wine, it's not good. And if you love the wine, even if everybody else thinks it's weird, it's really good. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line here. At the same time, flawed wine is flawed wine. I mean, if it's really flawed, it's a problem. And we shouldn't be celebrating that somehow or another a flaw in wine is unique and a signature of a place. It's not. It's bad winemaking.
You've highlighted several times throughout the conversation how collaborative your professional life has been and how you're not taking credit for making it on your own, that a lot of people are involved that were instrumental in it. And I think for you guys that are listening, think about someone that achieved so much in the industry through hard work and dedication and kind of singular minded pursuit of excellence, and then decided to start a whole other chapter.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
I know, it sounds crazy to me too, but it's been too much fun. It's the year following, the 12 months following leaving, so 12 months starting in May 2017 to, let's say, May 2018, were probably the most fun, energizing year of my entire life. It was a blast. Finding new grape sources, talking with people, rethinking, looking at different possible label ideas. All of these things were really, really fun. Plus, you were spending tons of money, and there was no requirement to sell anything yet because you didn't have anything in the bottle. Which is kind of, if you've ever done it, you know that that's really the best part of it. At some point, you get to a place where you have wine in bottle, ready to sell, and then it's still fun, but not as much fun as just getting started is probably the most fun.
And see, now you can't even outsource half the responsibility. Prior to that, it was a partnership, so if something went wrong, you could theoretically blame other part. No, I'm kidding.
No, we were all in the same boat. And
you were saying
that, you know, collaborative, and I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. So my theory at the beginning of Patson Hall, and it's still that way today, is this isn't about me succeeding and, you know, crushing my enemies. This is the way that I've always thought you could be successful is to have enlist as many other people in making it worth their while for you to be successful. In other words, if I'm successful, so are you.
Yeah.
And that would be like restaurants. So if I'm successful and you have my wine on your wine list, then people are going to say, "Oh, look, I want to drink that." So you're successful too. If you're a retail store and you have my wine on your shelf and people go, "Oh, look at that, I want to buy it." Well, you're successful too. And when you try to do it all by yourself, I've always thought the idea of 100% direct to consumer was really a bad idea. Because of this, you've now limited the people that are going to be successful with your new little brand to just you. Mm-hmm. And there's fewer people out there who are going to be talking about it because of that. So this is the Old Vine. Next is Old Vine. This actually, yeah, Le Rivière Chardonnay from Maritana. That's 55% Old Vine Chardonnay.
Okay.
45% a vineyard called Big River, which I can't get anymore, but
The perfume on it is quite something.
It's really good, isn't it? And it's interesting contrast coming right out. I haven't done it in a while this way, but coming right after the Terminum, mm-hmm. it really has a whole different kind of swagger to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and exactly. No, it's definitely quite central, and the texture is very, very important because as I'm tasting it as we're talking, it has a lot of palatal presence, but it's not weighty by any stretch of imagination. It's assertive. It's there, the structure, but it's at the same time it's quite supple. And to me, that's very important in any wine, but particularly in the Chardonnay.
So you were mentioning earlier that I've been hanging out with French people, and because mm-hmm. I have a French partner in the Terminum wine. One of the things that I hear them say a lot, one of their favorite descriptors is fresh. They want wines that are fresh, that have freshness to them.
Yeah.
And they're not talking about young wines. They're talking because even old wines can have a fresh element. So I'm still trying to figure out exactly what they mean when they say that, but I kind of think I've got it figured out. It's a brightness and aliveness that's there, and that's, I hadn't really had a word for it before, but that's what I've been striving for even before we began talking about it with Francois.
Yeah, there's a certain purity to this wine, but at the same time there's this unctuous quality. So it's a bit, it almost seems kind of intuitive, but it's sort of like an old soul in a new body.
An old soul in a new body. Well, I guess that just described me, didn't it?
Or
a young soul in an old body.
I think you know, your wines reflect you. The wines reflect the maker. So I think it's important that there's a consistency there.
Next up is that shop block. And I want everybody to remember every time they see this label that it was 50-year-old Chardonnay vine. So I added to the shop block name 1967, which is the year it was planted.
Wow.
So the reason where this came from was I was concerned making wine at a brand new facility for me and using grapes I had never used before. I was concerned that I wanted to have control of the fermentation. So I was using my two favorite yeasts across the board on the Pinot as well as on the Chardonnay. And I got about 2/3 of the way through the barrel down on the shop block, and I'm working with this guy, and I say to him, those last 6 barrels we are not going to inoculate. We're going to try a native yeast fermentation on it and see how it turns out. Figuring I wasn't excited about losing 6 barrels, but if they went sideways, I knew that it wasn't going to be a major impact on the total resulting wine. Those were my favorite 6 barrels immediately. Well, we tasted this wine together.
We did.
Out of barrel. And those 6 barrels were really extraordinary right from the very beginning. And I wanted to honor that and keep it separate, not just blend it into the La Riviere blend. So I took a couple of new barrels as well as a couple of other selected barrels. So this is not entirely native yeast fermentation, but primarily native yeast fermentation.
I should remember how excited you were when you tasted them with me.
Well, I was sort of a requirement of doing Terminum was to do native yeast fermentation. So we did it there as well. And it worked really well at Envy Winery, where I'm making the Terminum and the Cabernet. On the Terminum wines, it worked really well. And it worked really well on this. So I'm 2018, I went 100% with Maritana, all in on native yeast. So it's everything, Pinot and Chardonnay is 100% native yeast for 2018.
Well, off the bat, this is such a significant wine. I'm looking at the 1967 on the label, and I'm like, I think it's got 50 years in it. And I'm not, by all means, don't think that I'm suggesting that. Seriously, I mean, it's said in jest because I would not be so presumptuous as to suggest the age. Potential age is really more a question for you. But it certainly has so many years in it and so much life. Might outlive me.
That, when I was making the 2017 Cabernets, that really struck me. That very likely these Cabernets could go 25 or 30 years. And it seems reasonable to assume that I may not be around after 30 years. So, I knew I was making, every year I make wine now, I know a portion of it will be alive and beautiful after I'm not here.
It's sobering.
Poignant.
Yes. And at the same time, a very beautiful sentiment because you're creating something with a life of its own.
It absolutely does. Yeah. This was really fun. And these old vines, they look old. Huh. They're big, gnarly vines. They're brawling. They're not little tiny sticks anymore. And they're not declining. 2018 produced the biggest crop they've ever gotten out of this section. Which is hilarious.
Right. Wow.
50-year-old Chardonnay vines, outperforming the younger vines around it. It certainly will not happen again in the foreseeable future, but it was an extraordinary year for them, and they stepped up and really made a big crop.
How fortuitous for you. I guess a fatalist part of me says it was meant to be. You've extended yourself by starting this project, you know, from the heart, and it happened. You got the fruit that really speaks to that.
I think so, yeah. I love the idea of old vines. I mean, so many people just sort of assume that older vines are automatically going to make more dramatic wines. And it's not always the case. Especially as they get older, they can have disease problems. They can be, you know, they can, there's all kinds of ways that vines can go wrong as they get older. But there are significant benefits of old vines as well. You know, the root structure, for example, in 2017, blistering weather at the very beginning of harvest, if you remember, wow, it got hot. And these older vines just sort of pumped right on through, not a big change up or down in terms of sugars. It had such deep roots and was so set up to be able to survive that, and I think younger vines really struggled in 2017. Initially, they probably recovered because the heat didn't last super long time, but the old vines just sort of shrugged off that heat like it was no big deal.
There's a teachable moment again, the automatic assumption that old vines mean good wine is not the case. It's actually highly individual. And yes, this is a kind of wine that you need to have a conversation with, for sure. It's not something you just drink. I think it's
I like drinking it. I drink it right out of the bottle.
I want photographic evidence because I don't believe you.
Look, I think it's under hashtag, what's it, Bob Dylan tasting or something like that. Dylan tasting.
Oh, it does exist. I must research that. And here we have...
This is the Hanson Hill. Hanson Hill, Hillside, all old Wente clone Chardonnay. I know other people have interesting spots from Dutton Ranch as well, and there are some others. Who knows, maybe I'll get something else in the future, but I really think this is the spot for Dutton Ranch. It's incredible, the intensity and the nerve that this wine shows. I mean, it seems to have this sort of electric undertone to it.
Your wines are spectacularly different.
This comes out of this comes out of what we were thinking about when we were doing Patson Hall too. I mean, if you're going to do a single vineyard wine, it needs to be different enough to justify it.
Yep.
I like all of these, but oh my God, this Hanson Hill, man.
You have a favorite child, huh?
I see how I got really quiet. I didn't want the other ones to hear and get upset, so.
We won't tell. I love your label, too.
Thank you.
It's what a label, I think, it should be. It's simple, it communicates.
I wanted it to be artistic as well. So, you know, that sort of stylized grape cluster. And several people told me, oh, black labels, man, they're this the bane of high-quality wines. I thought, I don't think so, but okay, if you think so.
I think that, like I said, it's what it should be. I mean, the wine speaks for itself. So the label doesn't need to be busy and overly saturated to have too much information on it.
It looks cool as a poster.
There's a poster.
There is a poster. I have a small number of posters.
Are you signing them and sending them to the consumers?
If they call and ask me for one, I'll send it to them.
Well, there you go. So there's your opportunity to call in and get a very limited poster with Donald's signature. And while you're at it, probably should get some wine too, because what I'm tasting, you need to taste as well.
Yeah, I'm really happy with these. And as I said, the 2018s are showing beautifully as well. For Chardonnay, 2018, the difference between what I did in 2017 and 2018, obviously native yeast fermentation, but it was really obvious early in August that there was a big crop out there. And I was convinced I'd already blown my budget. Mm-hmm. So I was telling people that were friends of mine, we were having conversations about grapes, and I'd say, I can't buy any more grapes because I know everybody's going to come in big, and my budget's going to get blown. And practically those words had just come out of my mouth, And the phone starts ringing, and I look down, and it says Kent Ritchie. Now, I don't know if everybody who's listening knows who that is, but a legendary grower, Ritchie Vineyard, number of people have done this as a single vineyard designate. And I was hoping a couple of years ago to be able to sign up for some fruit from him. And when he called me, I just looked at the phone before I even picked up the phone. I hope Kent's not listening. He'll raise the price of my grapes. And I said, I'm buying more grapes, even though I can't afford them today.
You did not say no to Kent Ritchie.
I did not. So I have about 200 cases of Ritchie Vineyard 2018 Chardonnay still in barrel to go with the Dutton, the two different Dutton Ranch wines and the La Riviere.
Well, what I'm hearing is that there are very limited quantities of the wine, so...
I mean, La Riviere, there's a little bit of that. There's going to be about a little over 1,000 cases of that, but the single vineyard wines are like 250.
The single vineyard wines will sell out first, so you know what? If you're listening and if you're a fan of Donald Pats, you know, not just formally Patson Hall, but what he created... these small lots of wine really kind of need to make their way to your cellar. If nothing else, it's a test. If you like Patson Hall Chardonnays, he already said those are remarkably different. What I'm tasting is not just difference, it's just a story that I'm listening to as I'm sipping in those wines. And because there's such small amounts of them, I think you guys need to pay close attention because the fruit sources are as stellar as it gets.
Yeah, the Hanson Hill block would undoubtedly be given Grand Cru status if they were doing that in California today. Shop block, by virtue of being old vines, would be highly regarded. And the fact that it's, you know, that there's multiple vineyards, but also some very extraordinarily good vineyards in the Maritana La Riviere, I think makes it a special wine as well. 2018, I've got several new sites that are going into the La Riviere Chardonnay, including some Martinelli fruit and a vineyard that has been done as a single vineyard designate called Susanna's Vineyard, but I'm just using it in the La Riviere.
Well, you clearly dedicated to producing things of significance. So really, we talked a lot about flavor profile, but and it's a very worthy discussion, but really everything that makes it in the bottle is world-class, top-notch. It's something that's important.
Thanks. Well, should we try some red wines?
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.